Today is March 19, 1980. My name is Myra Allegert, and I am visiting Mr. Warren Beach at his home in San Diego. Just out of curiosity, Mr. Beach, as a former administrator of the museum, what we now call the museum, what does the name change from San Diego Fine Arts Gallery to San Diego Museum of Art mean to you? Do you have any?
Well, it isn't too difficult for me to enjoy and even sometimes remember, partly because I had tried to get the name changed to something of that sort. I'd forgotten about it, but Martin Peterson told me that I had done so, but without success. Because a good part of my energy went into trying to show that it was a general art museum rather than a fine arts gallery, which suggests to most people just painting and sculpture, no decorative arts, and perhaps a less lively place. To other people, it suggests a commercial dealership.
The gallery
word especially. And essentially, that's the museum has been moving in the direction of a general art museum with activities, much more variety of exhibitions and so on, ever since I got here. Probably started before I arrived.
Did the museum belong to the Western Association of Museums? Tell me a little bit, because it comes into the record only as of 1973.
Oh, I'm sure we belonged all the time I was here, as far as I can recall. Perhaps that was because, was it in 1973 that we had the meeting down at San Diego, jointly sponsored by the Museum of Man, Museum of Natural History, and the Fine Arts Gallery.
That may well be.
I think possibly that was
it. Where the meetings were.
And that year, either Clark Evernham or I was president. So I suspect that's the case. But if I recall correctly, there were two organizations, one of which was Western Association of Art Museums, and one of which was the Western Association of Museums. And we have the same distinction on the national level also, except that there it's the National Association of Art Museum Directors, which is a rather small group, and fortunately our museum was included in this. And then a National Association of Museums, which is all kinds of museums and all kinds of museum personnel, if that will clarify it any.
Mm-hmm. And the San Diego Museum of Art belongs to both organizations.
Yes.
Correct.
Well, so far as I know, Mr. Gardner was, it depends on the director and the museum as to whether you're in the National Association of Art Museum Directors. For instance, in Minneapolis, nobody liked Mr. Davis when he was director enough among his colleagues, and it was the museum was blackballed for 3 years, and they were just about to let him in out of shame that it shouldn't be represented.
Is this the
when
Walker?
He was permitted to let go. No, the Minneapolis Art Institute. The Walker, so far as I know, has always been in it from the time that they first got it.
Okay. Let's backtrack a little bit to your preparation for having become the director out here. In other words, your education. You were born in?
I was born in Minneapolis. From the age of nine, I was in school in Switzerland at the age of nine, then private schools back in Minnesota. And then I was at École de l'Île de France, outside of Paris, for 2 years before going to Andover, where I spent a normal 4 years. Then I had 5 years studying painting at Yale. And after World War II, I took a second, at Yale, and then a year taking a master's at the State University of Iowa, which was followed by a job at the Walker Art Center, which we just mentioned, from which I was drafted, and during that period I got married to Eleanor. And after the war years, she was living back home in a suburb of Boston. I took a second master's at Harvard, where I studied museology with Paul Sachs and certain other great people and more art history. And it was from that experience that I, instead of getting into teaching, I got into museum work. Teaching seemed to require a doctorate, even though a Bachelor of Fine Arts from Yale and 2 master's degrees was certainly the equivalent of it.
I thoroughly agree on that. You mentioned Iowa. Mr. Peterson did ask me if I would inquire if you worked with Jean Charlot.
No. Oh, what? Excuse me. Yes, I took my master's in fresco painting. Mm-hmm. And Jean Charlot was there the summer that this was completed, so I did work under him. I did a Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse on about a 10-foot square wall with some pipes and a door cutting into it. And Charlot was a delightful man to work with. But it did bother me a little that he would say, "Mr. Beach, why don't you go out and lie down under a horse and see what it looks like?" Because when I was in the Army, I almost got into the cavalry at Fort Riley. Fortunately, I made the mechanized cavalry. And I've always felt about horses like the debutante in Dwight Fisk's record, who'd never been on or off a horse before, and all the horses knew it. I'd been on a few, but never with a lesson.
Okay, so your main memory...
I think probably that great mural has disappeared now.
Your main memory of Mr. Charlot is stay off the horse.
Yeah. No, as a matter of fact, there was a one-man show of his on view here when I came to job interview, which Carl Skinner had arranged. And I think Charlot had taught in this area for a while.
As far as working with him, what was he doing? Supervising? That's not the right word.
He was a guest artist brought in to teach fresco, but they had had a class in it. I think it was taught by a man by the name of Jones. So that I'd done 5 or 6 panels before Charlot arrived on the scene. I had some sense of the medium.
Very interesting. In your background, were there any artists? What led you into the field?
Actually, we don't have any visual artists in my background. My father is a very prolific writer in the field of English literature. And
he isn't Joseph Warren Beach, is he?
It is Joseph Warren Beach.
Well, indeed. As a matter of fact,
and of course, my grandfather is Cyrus Northrup, who was the second president of the University of Minnesota and was taught something or other practically all of his life, but was primarily a great public speaker, fundraiser, and administrator.
Let's review your education briefly. You said you went to school in France as early as age 9.
Now that was in Switzerland.
Switzerland.
Near Geneva. And then when I was, I think 11 and 12, I was in school in France for 2 years. And actually, the language held so that when we returned in 1772, to let Henry Gardiner get started without being interrupted, for one thing. We settled there because we discovered through Robert Penn Warren who had spent a year in this house, that here was a possible place where we could be central to a lot of other things and not have it to travel all the time, because we went to Europe for about 8 months on that trip. And it was there that, scared to death, I wouldn't be able to start painting again, really, with some seriousness. We found such a compatible climate, so much like San Diego, but with these beautiful old hill towns, stone, beautiful architecture. Any old house was beautiful. Little outdoor stairways and all that sort of thing. I found that I was able to get painting, and probably did most of the best work I've done since I left the museum during our two visits in 1970 and 1972.
You like the brilliance of the color?
It was the same brilliant light as we have here. It's very much like northern Italy, with a sweep across. And from this house, we could see the Mediterranean quite often. A little slice of it would be an inch high in a landscape, you know. It's like having a house on the bayside of Point Loma, where you pay $5,000 because you can see a few squares of water.
Out of the upstairs bathroom window.
Yes. But I came back from those 2 years with about 50 oils, which were quite different. I got a new palette, lighter palette. And there's certain periods in your life when things work just right. When I was in the Aleutian Islands for 2 years, out on Adak, I couldn't work outdoors at all, but aside from portraits of my fellow officers, I did a lot of little watercolor sketches from pencil notes, which I think are some of the best work I ever did. In the romantic years of working off the bridges as a young man in Minneapolis, often at night, Columbus, Ohio, I drove home from the art museum there, down a street which was almost entirely inhabited by black people, and was fascinated by the figure groupings and so forth. And I have a fairly good body there of what you might call semi-satirical figure paintings. I think they're semi-satirical, but not in a nasty sense.
Okay.
So the pleasure I get out of watching, people watching, is a great thing anyway.
Mm-hmm. So you came to San Diego in 1955.
Yes. We drove as a family in two cars from Columbus, Ohio. Our kids had been in camp and we'd been in Europe for 6 weeks. I was hired before that, but I persuaded the trustees that they weren't going to have to pay for the trip, and it wasn't waiting too long to have their director with this new experience. And they also wanted us to visit Peggy Guggenheim in Venice, which we did, and got a couple of gifts of paintings from her on that occasion.
Did she give them to you at that time? Or
One of them at that time, and a couple of others have come since then. Mm-hmm. But there had been a misunderstanding and a break in the giving that she had been... they thought they were getting several things that they hadn't gotten, so they asked me specifically to go see her. It's part of this whole business of collecting without money to collect.
Yeah, as director... You felt that your primary concern was to see that the collection was built up through gifts. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. Well, when I came here, I put this whole matter sort of into something of a nutshell. The museum had a budget of $75,000. $1,000 of that was allocated to changing exhibitions. You couldn't put on a decent one today for less than $30,000. And the exhibition spaces, of course, for things other than the collection, were very poor and only part-time available, you might say, without burying some fine things back in storage. the funds for acquisition of works of art, or the total we had was the income from $18,000 capital. So that the only things we could buy was an occasional, maybe a chair, a piece of graphic art, something of this sort. And everything else had to be come from gifts. So that much of my work was that of finding donors, finding people who could be persuaded to buy things, who had things that they would give to the gallery. The other side of the coin, of course, being so that the collections could be built up and, of course, had to be properly maintained. We needed funds to get good programming going. We had no place for school classes. One little office space was used for many years for a very modest single class on Saturdays. I took the point of view and told the trustees in my job interview that their primary dual function was, of course, to determine the basic nature of the institution and to raise the funds necessary for its growth, for it to become a fine museum. But this was a beautiful building and a quite famous old master collection in the Flemish and Italian and particularly Spanish field, which was 65% supported in its operation by the city. The year after I got here, we began getting funds from the county, which was dirt poor for what it was. I didn't even have a secretary. I think we had one secretary that everybody used, one curator, two curators, Carl Skinner, who was a curator of Asiatic Arts and was acting director when I came here. And then I got Martin Peterson shortly after I got here. A tiny staff.
I read someplace that you have 13.
And what it is today is just fantastic, even though it's taken quite a few years. There were plans when I arrived. May Marcy, who was the only woman then to have been president of the Fine Arts Society, was a great person and a great mover. And she wanted the auditorium, the library, additional exhibition space. And this whole thing was gone over. She had gotten Jim Copley on the board, for instance. And it was due to Jim Copley, basically, and perhaps the fact that I went to Andover, that I got the job.
You mean the good old buddy system?
On the way out, I stopped off in Aurora. It took a lot of doing to be able to see him at all, but and I was scared to death I wouldn't recognize him. He was in the class behind me at Andover. Of course, he had a photograph of me. But it worked out so that I met his wife first and didn't call the butler Mr. Copley, I presume. But that's a whole chapter in itself. But the directors... Could I give you a... even if we have to come back again... a definition, of perhaps, of an art museum director in a museum where they aren't full of specialists. One is that he's a catalytic agent trying to lead persons and committees of divergent interests in some joint useful direction. He is also, in the poorer museums, a person who has neither the time nor the money to go see in the flesh all the things which his trustees can go see and which he's supposed to know all about. I don't know whether that should go into the record or not, but
they're
two really good definitions.
Yes, excellent. Just to diverge for a minute, did you ever have any difficulty with your board of directors? There are endless stories of museums torn apart, their growth and their goodness and their beneficial.
Well, I won't name any names, but I had very good luck on the whole. I only had one chairman of the board who thought absolutely the opposite way from the way I thought. It was very difficult to deal with, and I almost resigned under him, but he made me so mad, and most of my staff so mad, that I didn't. Otherwise, I had for 2 years, unfortunately. I thought I'd solved the problem of his having another year. But on the whole, they were very good. I was able to work well with them, and quite a number, like Mike Gonzalez and Tom Stevens, are very close friends of ours still. They were each 3 years, as I recall.
Did you feel that they had a great deal of power to force you to do something that you didn't want to do or you didn't believe in? Or
they had a lot of power, but the only one who tried to push me definitely in certain directions that I either felt it was premature to go into, or that I felt that it wasn't right to do. On the whole, I was very lucky in the sense that nobody was trying to tell me what exhibitions to put on or what programs. They would suggest things, and of course this gallery is full of committees. One of its difficulties is it has so many semi-autonomous committees, such as the Asiatic Arts, which was one of the forming committees, the Art Guild, which was one of the groups that came together to form the Fine Arts Society, and later on the Latin American Committee. Now I understand we have an African Arts Committee here. Now, the Modern Art Committee was one which kind of came and went, and came mostly out of San Diego State professors and our art-interested people. And at one time they were raising money through perfectly good programs at the gallery, but the money went to scholarships at State or something other than the museum.
How do you control that?
Well, it's very difficult, because these committees tend to have a representation on the board and are composed of people with a lot of friends in town, of course. It's like trying to control the... I never really succeeded. We've got more committees rather than fewer. And the director or one of his curators was expected to be at the meetings of all these committees, which took an inordinate amount of time, but now and then was a good form of self-preservation also, because you could steer them away from dangerous ideas like enormous exhibitions or art acquisition and loans is another one, which was a very tricky one. How do you get somebody to give you a work of art without knowing whether that'll be accepted or not? You really have to do a double take on that in order to make it work. Where there's any question on the piece.
Yeah. Wouldn't you have been at least an ex officio member of each one of these committees? And for instance, on acquisition,
yeah.
You could have the veto power, couldn't you?
Well, I don't think I was a voting member of anything. In Columbus, the director wasn't even invited to attend the Board of Trustees meetings until after they'd lost Phil Adams to Cincinnati, and then they got a little brighter. And they had two boards. They had a Board of Trustees, which was all men, mostly working on financial support things, and a Board of Managers, which was like putting all our committees together into one board, and mostly women, though not entirely. It wasn't limited to them.
You were
but
there.
Their wonderful work is done by these committees, and I would die if I had to supervise the marvelous party giving and social affairs. The most skilled people in the city were doing that work for us. When we got a library, the devotion of the people there, the gallery guides is another one. Fantastic what's done. No European museum has any of this kind of stuff.
Yeah, the volunteers.
Yes.
Let's see, just one thing about your work prior to coming here. You were at Iowa in 1940, just before the Second World War, and that's where you met Joan Charlot.
Yes.
You worked that, with
I did my master's in fresco painting. Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, which was a about 10-foot square wall with some pipes up and cutting into one corner and a door near there. And he was a very, very good teacher, a very nice man, though he did wonder why I didn't go lie down under a horse to see what it looked like. And I'm the guy that's only been on three horses, never had a lesson, like the person in Dwight Fisk's record who'd never been on or off a horse before, and all the horses knew it. Eleanor, and my wife, incidentally, rides quite well, and when I was a corporal at Fort Riley in the mechanized cavalry, she managed to ride with the officers' wives. I was also doing some artwork for Colonel Holman and the post commander, and did portraits of a number of the main officers who helped me get into ordnance school, thanks partly to that.
Well, when you were in the Aleutians...
I started out being drafted, in other words, and I got to the Aleutians as a second lieutenant after going to Aberdeen, proving grounds where I thought I might learn something useful like auto mechanics, but they had plenty of people who knew about that, so I ended up in ammunition.
That's very valuable right now to you, isn't it?
Yeah, well, none of it ever got used when I was on ADAC either, I'm happy to say.
Oh, that was a cold place to get out of the war.
It was one of the best painting areas I'd ever been in, though it all had to be done after some little pencil sketches, because it's either too wet or too windy to ever work outdoors.
Then, as the museum director, with a thought firmly in mind that you wanted to help the collection to grow, tell me about your relationship with Earl Grant and Mr. Munger. How did you meet them? Were they already involved in the museum when you got here?
Very slightly. They had been strong backers of the La Jolla Museum, which was, I think, called the La Jolla Museum of Art then, and to the point of helping to put up their exhibitions and all kinds of things. And we're very close to the then director, Frieda Clapp, who, among other things, was an expert in graphic arts, and who I think they had known back in Minneapolis when she was running a gallery and they were in the interior decorating business. But she was let go by the directors of the La Jolla Museum, as I understand it, in the newspapers before she heard about it. And that made them very mad, and they had in the meantime bought a house here on Point Loma. And the Steinbecks knew them quite well. Now, Stanford Steinbeck was the president the second year I was here, and just for that 1 year, and got us together. And this grew into an increasing friendship, and Mrs. Beach was helping Earl keep help in the house and all kinds of things, and I would see him four or five times a week. I'd stop in on my way home for a drink, something of that sort. He was quite old. Plenty was Mr. Munger, sort of the enthusiasm that made the things go, their art collecting. He was a gourmet cook, a wonderful gardener, and all kinds of things. After his death, Earl became more and more indrawn. But everything they bought was, isn't it the most wonderful thing you've ever seen? And it is that kind of a collection. Mostly small items, great variety. They bought mostly from, after I got here at least, from the Hatfield Galleries in Los Angeles. And Dal was a gourmet cook, and he would come down with a whole carload of paintings, and they'd spend 3 days trying out paintings in their living room, other place in the house, and cooking up a gourmet meal. And it was because of this living room, when they went to Europe, after we'd seen Peggy Guggenheim, They liked the bocce that we bought from her very much. It was the first big modern painting we'd ever bought. And they got two of them. But while they were away, I persuaded them to, for safekeeping, to put their whole collection down at the gallery.
Oh, what a strong
imagination. And then on the next trip they took, or by that time, we had